Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Steph, and this is the Don't Buy Her Flowers podcast. And today's intro is coming to you from inside my car in the dark on Minchin Hampton Common. So I grew up near Stroud in Gloucestershire, and our Don't Buy Her Flowers warehouse is in Stroud. So I'm spending a few days here, staying at my mum and dad's tonight. And it's beautiful, actually. It's pitch black, but all the stars are out, and I'm in a lay-by with a few other cars, and just hoping I don't get mistaken for someone who is dogging. But other than that, everything's fine. It's fine. Nothing to see, just a woman talking into her phone in the dark. But I wanted to introduce our guest today. It is Helen Russell. So Helen is a researcher, author, journalist, and speaker. And she has written books on happiness. She spent the last 10 years researching happiness. And she started to realise that people are terrified of sadness. So her latest book is called How to Be Sad. It's just come out in paperback, and it's available in Don't Buy Her Flowers packages. And it's all about being sad better, and actually that to be happy, you also need to feel sad. And she brings it to life with her own stories about infertility and having an eating disorder and grief. And it really is, like, I talk about how it's helped me with a conversation with my son. Like, it's such a good book, this idea of accepting sadness, and actually that it's trying to teach you something. When you feel all the feelings, they're trying to tell you something, and if you bury them, it will come back and bite you. So Helen speaks brilliantly about that, and we also talk about the idea of, what have I got to complain about? You know, well, I shouldn't be sad because I've got a nice life and I should be really happy, and just that's not really how it works. So we talk about that. And I would really recommend the book. But first of all, we can start by hearing our conversation. I would love for you to rate and review and subscribe to the podcast. And I hope you enjoy it.
Hello.
So what I was going to start with is, you spent 8 years researching happiness.
Yeah.
And you have discovered a startling fact, which is that most of us are terrified about being sad. So this is where this whole book has come about. So How to Be Sad, Everything I've Learned About Getting Happier by Being Sad Better. Kick me off.
So basically, back when we could travel the world, I would travel a lot, talking about my books and my work, and wherever I was in the world, largely actually in the US and the UK, I would give talks, or I'd do interviews, and someone would come up afterwards and say, you know, how can I be happy? And often they were people who perhaps had just lost a loved one, or people who'd been made homeless or made redundant, and there was still this expectation, well, why aren't I happy? And I would almost feel like saying, well, you know, sometimes it's normal to be sad. Sadness is the normal, sane response when we experience losses or disappointment. But I feel as though in much of the world, this idea of the pursuit of happiness has become so all-encompassing that people just don't want to be sad. We hear all the time how happier people are healthier. Well, those statistics are a little bit wrong, or maybe we'll get to that later. But but actually this idea that we must be happy all the time, I felt like maybe I had not, I had done people a disservice in previous books by talking about happiness as though it meant never being sad, because that isn't what happiness means. Sadness is going to happen. So we have to figure out a way of doing it right.
And the book is part memoir, part manifesto. So what I think what makes it really readable, obviously, it's your story. So you talk about sadnesses that you've had, including grief and infertility and anorexia and like difficult things, which really bring it to life. So compared to if it were just a straight academic book. But what is really interesting is that you're basically pointing out that everyone kind of wants to avoid sadness. And one of the, a really strong quote in there from Julia Samuels, who's a psychotherapist, I think, says it's not the pain of loss that damages individuals, but the things they do to avoid the pain. So grief is obviously a massive one for lots of people. Like you say, if they're going, well, can I not be happier? But you essentially quite early on in the book, you kind of establish that we have to feel all the feels.
Yeah. Yeah, because actually, yeah, she's absolutely right. The things that we do to try and avoid it. So the fear of facing our sadness can feel overwhelming, but the cost of not doing so is far greater. There's lots of studies to show that if we attempt to suppress that sadness or suppress our emotions, it will backfire spectacularly. I think of it as like a beach ball almost that you're pushing. You try and push it underwater in a swimming pool, it'll pop up somewhere. Mm-hmm. So yeah, personally, I had had my sister died when I was little of sudden infant death syndrome. It was like my first memory. We all have stuff. I think that's what I wanted to get across, is that I'm not special. We all have stuff. My dad left, I don't have a relationship with him. As he said, like infertility, anorexia, everybody will experience this loss and heartache at various times. And if we don't know, if we don't culturally talk about it, then you just feel so alone. It's so isolating. So yeah, I guess I wanted to look at the unhelpful coping mechanisms that many of us cling on to when things feel really hard, and also just accept that stuff happens to all of us. So we can't just ignore it.
When you write about your sister, you sort of, it's the very bad thing. It's the thing that no one ever really talked about. No one, and it is heartbreaking to like the thought of you with your pigtails sitting on the stairs waiting for your dad and not really knowing what's happened, only that your family had changed dramatically overnight. And you can picture that. And obviously when you're reading, you're going, of course that would have had an impact. Of course it did. But yet we, like you say, we kind of hide those feelings, or we expect people to kind of have a funeral and then we move on. And it's that really British thing, which is so strange.
Yeah. And it's this idea of what you don't talk about can't hurt you, which I think many, especially of maybe our generation's parents grew up with, for example. And we know now that the opposite is true, that not talking about something just means, especially for a child, that then you make it up. And what a child will make up will often be perhaps even worse than what has happened. And that was my experience as well. You know, nobody told me that really explicitly that my sister had died, or that my dad had left and he wasn't coming back, or what was going on. And so you're just kind of making up these crazy scenarios. We all have vivid imaginations. And it's just much more helpful, having spoken to lots of experts now, and really tried to get my head around it with the benefit of having a supposedly grown-up mind, of how actually, even with little children, you should talk quite clearly about loss and death and sadness from as soon as they are able to.
I think because I obviously, having been reading it again recently, and I think that thing with children about the fact that you kind of go, oh, it's fine. Oh, like if they cry, oh, you don't need to cry, everything's fine. And you kind of gloss over it. And if we're doing that when they're kids, then they don't learn how to be sad, or it's association with sad is bad. So don't let's skip over that. You're fine. But it was interesting because the other night, my 11-year-old, it was like Sunday night. And I think what he was feeling was like an anxiety, but he was worried. And he said, I'm worried. And he looked sad. And my initial reaction immediately was to go, you haven't got anything to worry about, everything's fine, you're fine. And instead I sat with him. I felt like an excellent parent, so thank you for the book. I sat with him, and he's getting quite big, you know, he's not long and he's going to be the same size, so I put my arm around him and I was just like, okay, let's go through all the things that you might be worried about. And we went, you know, we listed all the things that to him, his world are massive. So whether that was whether he'd done his homework right, whether he played okay in the match, that, you know, his rugby, or, and we went through everything and I could feel his shoulders come down. Oh. I know. And I was like, well, first of all, thank you, Helen. But I thought, God, because that's what we do. You kind of skip over it because what you want is for everyone to just be happy all the time. But then in having that conversation, and then it led me to kind of say, you do know if you're worried or sad about anything, you can always talk to me or dad like that. And he was like, yeah. And the next morning we talked about it again. And it was like, God, I think that's possibly changed the way I parent.
That's so amazing.
Yeah, but you're so it makes complete sense, because we probably grew up in an age where that wasn't the case, right?
And it's on reflex. You still see it in playgrounds everywhere. Someone falls over and they'll say, you get up, you're okay. Or like, don't cry. And it's with the best of intentions, but it just doesn't help. Even things like a child saying, I'm really scared of the dark. And then a parent says, oh, there's nothing to be afraid of. Well, actually, to that child, that there is. And there can be a great deal of shame attached if you feel like your feelings are wrong. If your emotional response is you're told that it's wrong, despite however much a parent might love you and be trying to do the right thing, as we all are, it can be really unhelpful. So yeah, you're right. It does come almost automatically, and it's trying to catch that and turn it around. And the same with Corona. I think we've been having a big thing right now about the idea that probably everyone will get it at some stage at school. And when that happens, there's no stigma, and we've got a plan, and this is what's going to happen, and it doesn't have to be something where shame is attached or anything like that.
And you write about perfectionism, and you call it like a silent killer. And I was watching one of your TED talks where you list all the issues that might come out of perfectionism. So I wonder if you could just explain that, because it's big. It's a bigger issue than people might probably think.
Yeah, it's huge, isn't it? And I think you and I probably grew up at the time when it was almost the acceptable flaw to state in a job interview or on your CV. You know, it's, oh, she's a bit of a perfectionist. Yeah. But it's no badge of honour. Yeah, so perfectionist tendencies have been linked to, let me see if I can remember the list.
So it's 2019.
OCD, PTSD, chronic fatigue syndrome, insomnia, indigestion, anorexia, bulimia, depression, anxiety, and even like early death. So, you know, it's really not a good thing.
Quite a lot.
And actually, quite a lot. And pre-pandemic, one of the lead researchers on this was saying this is going to be the next epidemic, is perfectionism. And, you know, the rise of social media and comparison, it's a real problem of people feeling like I am not enough unless I am perfect. And it's a real problem for those of us even who are adult, let alone, I mean, people growing up in this climate. It's a real challenge.
And you write about having anorexia in your 20s. And again, the book kind of takes you on this roller coaster, because it's another bit of the book where you go, oh God, like it's so sad, because having, and it's, again, I haven't really talked about it, but having had an eating disorder, not anorexia, but, and then lots of people close to me having anorexia, it's so isolating, and it is complete sadness. It's like this energy and focus that people put into it, and you link it to perfectionism, but it's so tragic, because you also know that it's such a waste. It's a waste of energy and time and all those things.
Yeah, I think so. Interestingly, there is a genetic element, but then it can also be societal. So I might have ended up a perfectionist without my personal family background. I might not have. And you know, we're all nurture nature, we're all a mix of the two.
So and I suppose it doesn't really help just to go, oh well, this is because this happened when
but you know, it's fascinating to, I think it's without wanting to kind of, everyone did their best raising the next generation, but it's helpful I think to look back and see, okay, so what do I want to do maybe slightly differently. I think that's that is helpful and valuable. But as you say, yeah, it's so all consuming, it doesn't give you the headspace to be thinking or doing a lot of the things that would be more advantageous to you and that would bring you more joy and fulfillment. And eating disorder is so all consuming. And yeah, it is just that. It's really sad.
And I think it's the coming out of the office to go straight into the gym, to go home, and it's really sad. But I think it's something that people don't really understand, and no one knows what to say. And in the book, actually, there's a couple of really good examples of what friends said to you who said the right thing, and then the friend people who said the wrong thing, like, you're looking well, which is like the worst thing you can say to someone. Because that basically, you take that as, oh, I've got fatter, right?
Yes. Yeah. Despite completely, again, very well-meaning, there were some male friends who when I was kind of on the road to recovery would say, oh great, you've got your boobs back. Well, that's really not, I mean, yeah, being sexualized in this way is not really what I'm going for right now. And then there were other people who said just the kindest things, that like, we love you no matter whether you are thin or not, we love you regardless of your job. Just this idea of that being enough, and the unconditional love is just obviously so important. And it's something that perhaps when you are in a dark place, you forget. So it's just always lovely to be reminded, or friends saying, like, I'm thinking of you, no need to reply, just checking in. It's good.
And what do you think of I suppose it's trying to deal with other people's reactions. So if you have opened up and you have said, I'm struggling and I'm sad, or, you know, I have an eating disorder, or I think I'm feeling depressed, or any of those things, what can people do if their reaction is one that really doesn't help?
I think you have to perhaps look elsewhere for support. I think that I have come to realize that for some people, I have to lower my expectations, which is kind of counterintuitive again. And we're all told to, you know, aim high the whole time, but a little like the perfectionism thing, I can't expect perfectionism in myself and I can't expect it in others. So if someone's reaction is not one that is necessarily helpful to me, and it's not, and, you know, to clarify, it's not because they say something I don't like, but if someone is in a dark place and perhaps one friend isn't able to offer that support, then you have to go elsewhere. You can't expect to change that person whilst you're in a dark place. You have to turn elsewhere for that support. And that can be hard, realizing that some perhaps people you care about or who are close to you aren't going to be the people who can support you in this, but sometimes that will be the case. And if you keep on banging on doors that don't open, you're just going to feel worse.
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? And if people just say stupid things, that you've got to, I suppose you have to protect yourself perhaps.
Yeah.
One of the worst things that someone said to you, well, this was about the perfectionism, was the boy who dumped you by telling you you were gone.
90% perfect.
What a dickhead.
Okay, thanks for that.
Yeah. Oh. To someone who is desperately trying to be perfect. It's like, oh.
But, you know, with my adult brain now, I can see, well, he's daft and that's impossible. But with my, you know, we know now that the brain carries on developing till we are maybe 25. And I think I was around 24 at the time. And so my brain at that time went, oh, right. Okay. Better try harder next time. It's just that trying hard all the time. Mm. Yeah. I think there's a lot to be said for the idea of good enough in everything.
Who is it? There was one of your experts talks about good enough. I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, quite a few do. So Dr. Tal Ben-Shahar talks about, he's written a great book on perfectionism, and talks about how, yeah, the road to anything is going to be more curvy than we might expect. It's not linear. We're not going to get somewhere. Mm. And then Winnicott, famous psychologist, would talk about being a good enough parent and how actually you can apply that to all of life. If you're striving all the time and obsessed with being the best or following a certain parenting route, for example, you're not going to do your kids any favors. Actually, psychologically, the best kids are parents who are kind of just muddling through and are not being so rigid in either, I don't know, Earth Mother or Gina Ford or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. There has to be kind of some flexibility and to model failure as well. I think that's really helpful increasingly to show that we all make mistakes. And if kids don't see their parents make a mistake, then they think they can't. And that's not helpful either.
Which is funny, because I don't think that was something maybe that our parents did worry about so much. That feels like more of a modern issue, right?
Yeah, we worry about everything these days.
Trying to get it right. Yeah. It's like, well, we have all this information, which we're constantly getting. So therefore, we should be able to do it better and we'll do it right. So although we might improve on certain things, we're probably, realistically, we'll be fucking up other things.
Yeah, no, I definitely think that we're just making different mistakes. I mean, certainly the kind of the 70s and 80s was the kind of frazzles for dinner parenting. And I watched so much television. Josh Widdicombe's new book, Watching Neighbours Twice a Day. I definitely watch Neighbours Twice a Day and probably Home and Away. I mean, I watched so many Australian soaps. My Australian accent is still really on point. But we didn't have as much information about what might be helpful with child rearing, but maybe that was a good thing. Maybe people were more relaxed in some respects.
Yeah. Well, someone was talking the other day about how your parents didn't necessarily advise you on what exams to take, like what options to choose and all that stuff. Whereas I think we will probably try and do that and talk about what career possibilities and all that stuff. I mean, mine just kind of let me loose.
Yes, but you had millions of siblings. I mean, there wasn't time for this. But also, my mum didn't know. Like, people didn't go to university much in my family. Like, I think my aunt did. So there wasn't so much of that idea of how you do that, how you navigate that world. Mm. We were all pioneers in some respects.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas we're all very involved with the school WhatsApps and the, dear God. It's a minefield. And then I'm kind of, one of mine's off to secondary school and I'm like, I won't know anything, which I think I'm kind of looking forward to, but also going, oh my God, like,
you'll learn long division again.
Yeah. And I was going to ask you, so you start by writing more about infertility, and the huge sadness that you felt with that, along with shame and embarrassment, which again is horrible given that it was completely out of your control. Like it's awful that people, that's how you're going to feel, but you really describe that you felt like a failure, your body felt like it was failing.
Yeah, I think it's that time I wanted kids so badly from the age of about 26. I was sort of, my body had this kind of really primal yearning, and it was all I could think about, again, becoming all consuming. Mm-hmm. And so I had years of fertility treatment. I call them the stirrups years. I spent so much of my time, maybe three mornings a week in hospital, naked from the waist down with my legs in stirrups. So there's the shame of not being able to have children when society tells me that's what I should be doing. There's the shame I feel like my own body has let me down. It might be my fault because of the anorexia. I feel as though everyone, I worked at Marie Claire at the time, so all of my colleagues were going off on maternity leave every week. I mean, there were so many baby gap booties going around. It was just torture. And also, we are socialized not to flash our genitals at strangers. And I was having to do this like three times a week. So it made sense. I understand why that shame was there, but it was just, I mean, heavy. It was all consuming and heavy. And there's so much interesting stuff around shame and how toxic it is and how it's different for men and women. And for women, it's often around these times of that we have expectations of what women should be doing at certain times. So trying to have a baby is a prime example. Men are not having it that much easier. There's a lot of shame around vulnerability and expressing emotions at all. So yeah, it's a really difficult one. I think, again, we don't talk about very much.
And you write as well about sort of post, so you have a baby and then you have twins via IVF.
Yeah.
Which is a lot.
It's a lot.
But you write about your experience of feeling then really lost and sad, and you end up going to the doctor. And I suppose I think of quite a lot of people who have struggled to have a baby that I know have almost found it even worse when they have a baby, because they have this feeling that they're supposed to be really happy.
Yes, the guilt.
Yeah. Like that's. Yeah. Can you describe that a bit? Because I think, and also, what can people do at that point?
Yeah, it's really, there are many kind of angles of attack coming on. So I think I also felt as though I had almost let down the team who couldn't have children, because then I felt I had kind of defected to the other side, and that talking about anything to do with having a baby now would somehow rub their noses in it. And I knew how painful that was. So yeah, there's this thing that you want for so long, and then you get it, and life isn't perfect, because it never is. And you're not happy all the time, because that's not how life works. And, you know, having a new baby, you're tired a lot of the time. Your body's been through a lot. I just wrote about post-traumatic stress disorder and childbirth, which is increasingly common. I now realize I had with my first, and I was on bed rest with the twins. So my body was a wreck. My mind was a wreck. You're tired. And it just felt impossible. It can be very lonely being a new mother anyway. But again, one of the great experts I spoke to, Dr. Tal Ben-Shahar, has talked about this thing called arrival fallacy, when you get the thing you wanted, and it's somehow, you're not cock-a-hoop all the time, you're still going to experience sadness. It can feel a little deflating. And I was very curious. I thought, well, how can motherhood, one of the supposedly most, in inverted commas, natural things in the world, how can that still count as an arrival fallacy? And he said, again, because of the media and because of the portrayals of it in every kind of Hollywood movie, it's one quick cough and then the baby arrives, and you know, it's, everybody looks beautiful the whole time. Having a small baby in the house is usually quite relaxing and joyous with some lovely background music. And the reality is, it's hard. It is. And so yeah, I felt enormous guilt around that. And I think when I just couldn't sleep at all, I started hallucinating colours, which I don't recommend anyone does. And I recommend getting help before that. But then I went to the doctor and got a prescription for antidepressants and got offered therapy, which was massively helpful. And I think different people will need different things. But speaking to Julia Samuel again, she made the great point that it doesn't have to be with a therapist, but it's the talking to somebody who listens without interruption that is the key thing there. So again, it's finding that person who is your kind of support buddy, somebody who is going to listen without judgment, and making an agreement to have a regular check-in. And it won't perhaps be it won't might not be your best friend. It might be that they can't perhaps help you on that one, but it will be somebody in your circle who can support you.
Is this what you call shit FM in the book?
Shit FM, yes, yes. Let me explain. So my friend Jill and I would just have this shorthand basically for when life had felt pretty bad for a few days, you know, and you just have those days, it just feels a bit awful. And the voices in your head, you know, negative self-talk and everything feels a bit terrible and grey. And we would message each other saying shit FM's been playing for a few days now. And then we'd meet for coffee. And then we'd talk and she'd talk and I would listen. And then I'd talk and she would listen. And we hadn't fixed each other afterwards. We weren't suddenly not sad, but we felt almost good sad because by talking about those feelings, we had learned to understand them a bit more, I guess. So that's been massively helpful for me. And then things like, I'm a big believer in the fresh air and getting out for a walk and doing all of the lifestyle things that we know are good for us. But yeah, I also needed some extra help. And I think it's really helpful to talk about these things so there isn't then stigma and shame about it. This idea of, well, you wanted a baby, you got a baby. What are you moaning about? Because it's still hard and that has to be okay.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
And just, you mentioned depression, and I think in the book, you talk about, obviously they're different things, sadness and depression, but what you're saying about is if we can work out how to be sad, potentially it avoids us from reaching that point which becomes depression.
Yeah, so like depression is a chronic mental mm-hmm. illness that needs help, and I've been there and got that t-shirt. But sadness is a temporary emotion we feel when we have experienced loss or disappointment, and sadness can be awakening. It can be a message to tell us what's wrong and what to do about it, but we have to listen. We have to be still enough to listen. And although there are genetic factors as well and lifestyle factors, studies show that we are more likely to let normal sadness tip into something else if we don't make space for it, if we don't take care of it. And also, I think there is a problem if we pathologize normal sadness, if we make it sort of a medical problem, then there's more shame around it sometimes, there's more guilt around it, and it doesn't mean that we are able to handle it when it next comes along. So for example, I think grief is a really good one, because not a really good one, obviously it's a really terrible one, but grief will happen. We will all experience that.
Yeah.
But in, to go a bit tech for a moment, the DSM, the American Manual of Everything to Do with the Mind, they took out the grief clause in, I think, 2013. So there used to be a clause that said you couldn't be diagnosed with depression within, I think, 2 months of experiencing a bereavement. And then this was done away with. And the people who did that said, well, grief and depression often go hand in hand, so it's important to catch it. Absolutely true. But being sad when we have lost someone is completely normal. It doesn't necessarily mean we are depressed. And I think the rise in diagnosis and prescribing around what might be normal sadness, I think could be helped with maybe perhaps more talking, a different kind of cultural approach, a different cultural acceptance of normal sadness. I think that you're much more likely to think there is something, in inverted commas, wrong with you if you're feeling sad in a world that tells you to be happy. And so a lot of the experts I spoke to, Dr. Lucy Johnson is very good on this. She says, don't ask what's wrong with you, but ask what's happened to you. Because like I say, we've all had stuff happen. So it's not necessarily that we are broken. We are going through tough times. So in a pandemic, for example, it's normal to feel sad and to feel blah. And it doesn't mean that our brains are somehow not working as they should.
That's really useful, actually. What's happened to you? Because, and it could be something that's happened a long time ago that you've just never dealt with, or it could be something that's gone on now. But it's that, why, oh God, I should be feeling really happy. It's like, well, no.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think that that what have I got to complain about? Do you have any experts on that? I think you do in the book, because I think that's probably for a lot of people who I know who do have, you know, they've got enough money and they've potentially got a setup that they're happy, you know, that they could be happy with, or they've got kids, or they've got whatever, all those things that should mean that you've achieved.
Yeah.
And so then they bury the sadness and say that they shouldn't talk about it. So all your points about, you know, doing something about it, they're completely ignoring because they're too busy thinking, well, I shouldn't be feeling like this. I'm really lucky. I've got it good. What do we do with that?
Yeah, I would say that every psychologist I've spoken to over the last kind of 10 years now has said, you know, pain is still pain, however privileged. There is no hierarchy of sadness. We all get to feel sad. We all get to feel all of our emotions. It's what we do with them that counts. And I think there are enough miserable billionaires to see that it's not money that makes us happy. It used to be, until recently, the old idea that, you know, money can't buy you happiness, and it didn't matter how much you earned over a basic threshold to make you happy. And depressingly, that has changed slightly because of income inequality around the world and well-being inequality. It means that if we are earning what might be termed maybe a comfortable amount, we are likely to be happier because we can afford all of these well-being measures, like living somewhere that's nice, like exercising, eating food that will make us feel good. And we can all feel bad about that, and that is incredibly unfair and awful. But yeah, I mean, inequality, even if you're really wealthy, studies show if you live in a neighborhood or live in, you know, a city like London, for example, where other people are not really wealthy, you're going to be less happy because you are experiencing, you may be in your own bubble, but you cannot help but see how other people are less fortunate around you. So inequality is a really interesting one that doesn't matter. Obviously, many people would prefer to be on the higher income side of the inequality, but if you're living in an unequal place, you're going to feel worse. So somewhere like Scandinavia, for example, where everyone gets taxed eye-wateringly high taxes, but it means most people are looked after, means levels of trust are higher, so you are going to feel happier whether you are a high or low earner. So I think money is no shield against unhappiness and discomfort.
Yeah, and I think I think it stops people from getting help potentially or talking about it. So that's the kind of biggest lesson there, really, because then you're stuck.
Yeah.
And still not feeling any happier. I was just going to ask you about the kind of rush hour that we talk about on the podcast. So one of your experts, so it's Alex, is it Soojung Kim Pang?
Yes.
I like the sound of him.
He's great. He emailed this morning.
Oh, did he? Yeah. Well, he talks about parenthood. He's very reassuring because he's like, parenthood is really hard. Like this stage we're in with small kids and trying to juggle it all is really hard. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, I can. He's I feel bad because his kids are a bit older now, and whenever I end up speaking to him, I kind of have a bit of a moan and give him a hard time and say, oh, patriarchy, this is all right for you and all you men folk hiding in your sheds while your wives make breakfast and do the packed lunches. And he's like, no, my kids are bigger now. They can make their own lunch. And I feel bad, but it's true. He has been really honest about how He calls children like vampires, cute, lovable vampires, but vampires nonetheless. But we've since spoken about this a little more, and he's been really honest, saying that until his kids were about 10, he says he achieved, I paraphrase, but very little of note, because he just can't. It's so full on. And again, this is like, you know, social media and the way we read about others' achievements in whatever field we're in. I mean, sometimes I will compare myself to people whose field I'm not even in and think, oh, why haven't I had a number one single? Oh, because I'm not, you know, I'm not.
I can imagine you've got, is it White Snake?
I love White Snake. I'm quite into the Babies now, another kind of 70s, 80s glam rock.
Right.
Yes. So it's really problematic because you'd never know what's happening behind the scenes. So I think that it's really important to kind of talk about that and cut some slack, and something always has to give. I was talking to my neighbor who doesn't have kids yet, and she was saying, well, I don't want to sacrifice my nice life. I get it. I really get it.
Yeah.
There is always a sacrifice. It's military planning. Your relationship may take a backseat. Your work might take a backseat. Nobody gets to have it all. And if they do, someone else in that family is not having it all. Mm. And I was getting quite worked up about it, but it's important to talk about.
Yeah. And this is exactly the rush hour where you're trying to, and you're like, you have for what looks like an amazing career. You know, you've got books, you've got TED Talks, you're a speaker, you're
an authority. But I haven't showered today, Steph.
Nor have I.
No, fine.
I did clean my teeth though.
Now, oh, well done.
I think that's winning. It's when you get to like 5 o'clock and go,
fuzzy.
No, I haven't. Like, oh God.
Yes.
I think, well, you talk about social media and being sad. It feels at the moment, I think there's lots of books coming out and lots of people discussing it. And I think it was John Ronson was on the Fortunately podcast with V and Jane, and he was saying the next thing that he thinks is going to be a big sort of discussion point is our internet use and the fact that we got given this thing how many years ago, and we're all like, oh, amazing, I can get on to everything all the time, I can order everything, it's instant. And all that. And then we didn't know what the fallout might be.
Yeah.
But in terms of being sad and feeling sad, how does that all fit together?
I think it's not helpful. I think there was a great Facebook study by Mike Viking from the Happiness Research Institute in Copenhagen. He asked normal Facebook users to come off Facebook for a week, and I think they were like 50% happier and less stressed after a week. I mean, there's so many studies showing how it impacts negatively on young people. There's been lots of studies because you're online, so you're comparing yourself, but also you're not doing the stuff that could make you happy, like being outside, like seeing friends. So
in terms of achieving, like you might be on there and thinking, oh, I wish I'd written a book, I wish I'd had my hit single or whatever, but those things take time, and you've just lost 3 hours of the day scrolling some shite on Instagram.
Yes. I spoke to a philosophy professor who I was terrified by. He's an expert in Kierkegaard, who's notoriously difficult 19th century Dane, and he basically said, in the olden days, you would compare yourself to perhaps the 30 people in your cohort or in your village, your community. And you might be doing quite well compared to Sue and Bob down the road. But now you're comparing yourself to maybe the top 1% around the world. And actually, you don't look so hot compared to, like, I don't know, Beyonce. And, you know, you're not doing as well as J.K. Rowling. There's always something, and we can know something logically, but there's a part of our brain that will go straight to, well, I'm not doing that. Why aren't I doing that? I think Kathy Rensenbrink, the writer, has a great tip that she won't go online until after 12 o'clock, after noon. So at least she has that headspace, that breathing space to think and to write and to I guess, have your own thoughts in the morning before you start all that. So I try and do that, but I think it's going on airplane mode as much as you can. In terms of sadness, it's really interesting as well. You a little bit felt it during lockdown at the beginning, but the quietness, you need some quietness to feel properly anything, and especially if sadness as a kind of more contemplative emotion. It's not like the kind of high octane extrovert one. So you need that quiet to hear the message that the sadness is trying to give you. And if you are constantly scrolling or trying to fill your time or distract yourself, then you can miss that. And I've spent years, you know, doing that, just thinking, oh, well, just keep busy. Along with the perfectionism, that was part of how I was raised, and you just keep going. But actually, if you don't stop and if you do fill all your moments, you're going to miss that message when it comes.
Yeah, so that you're always doing, and that links back to parenthood. Like, they're always having to be busy and do stuff with the kids, and you can't just rest, which we need.
Yes, and actually, Alex Sujong Kimpang talks about how rest doesn't necessarily just have to mean lying on a sofa or lying in your bed. It's active rest can count as well, but it's something where your brain can restore, and that's when you'll come up with good ideas. And I'm writing about creativity at the moment, and that's when we are at our most creative, like Paul McCartney came up with Yesterday in a Dream. People invented the sewing machine in a dream. The idea that when we stop, that's when the good stuff happens. But we have to allow ourselves to stop, and a lot of our lives at the moment are designed so that we never stop, which feels really problematic.
Do you think it will change? Do you think in 10 years time we'll look back and go, God, that was a mental time when everyone was constantly on their smart, you know, like in the same way that you have advisory of how much booze you should have a week?
Yeah, it keeps getting lower.
Yeah. Could that happen with social media or screen time? Or
that's so interesting. Well, there's so much around AI and how much
there's gonna be more of it.
Yes, yeah. I mean, and it might be in more things than we have currently. I think it's very hard to go to full Luddite and shut yourself off completely. It's really challenging. I think it's going to be really interesting how the next generation navigate that.
And so what are the things that people can do to help when they're sad? Like, what's the top 4 or 5 things?
Yes, I think things to be good sad are helpful. So I think it's firstly is not fighting it, because it's pushing down that beach ball, it's going to pop up somewhere. And then it's talking about it if you can. And if you're not ready to yet, you can just say, like, could you just sit with me for a bit? You know, a lot of especially men who I've spoken to said, I'm not ready to talk about how I'm feeling, but if I have a friend and we're just in the room together, that's a start, and that helps that thing going. But if you can get a buddy system going where you have someone who you have an agreement with that when you talk they'll listen, and when they talk you'll listen, that can be really helpful. I find the idea of getting some perspective massively helpful, and lots of studies back that up. So whether that's through getting up really high on a mountain, so you physically getting some perspective and seeing, it's not that my problems don't count, but actually humanity has been through a lot, and we do cope, and we have all experienced sadnesses. It's bigger than me. Yeah. And I think books can do that as well. As these times when we can't travel, books are a great exercise in empathy and brain scan show. When we read, we mentally rehearse the activities, sights and sounds that are happening in that book. So we feel less alone. We feel more connected to other people. And it's a good way. It's not negating our experience, but it's making us feel that other people have been through this. So yeah, maybe that's going to be okay. And then I think exercise is massively helpful, and it doesn't have to be loads. I think that's the thing really worth pointing out. It can be a 20-minute walk a day. Studies have shown that that is linked to a 30% reduced risk of depression. So it can help with low moods. It can help with managing normal sadness so that it feels bearable, but you're not pushing it away. You're maybe walking, even thinking about that sad thing, working out what it means, what you should do about it. But you'll keep yourself on a kind of healthy plane. And then I think doing something for someone else is really helpful. For all the people I spoke to, those who actually paid it forward or at their lowest thought, okay, is there someone else who's feeling sad as well? Or can I do something to help someone else, volunteering or donating, anything around the idea of warm glow giving? It's amazing. They can look at MRI scans now and see that our brains literally light up with the pleasure of doing good. So we should do it because it's the right thing to do. But the feel good is a nice added bonus.
Well, and there was an increase in that when the lockdowns were first announced, there was definitely loads more helping neighbours, going and doing their shopping and stuff like that. And it gave you a purpose at that point, I think. And so people would have had that feeling of, oh, this is nice. And
yes,
gratitude.
And actually loads of people I've spoken to since the book came out and since the first lockdowns have said that although none of us are where we perhaps thought we'd be right now, there is this increased sense of community. Maybe it's community WhatsApp groups, or whether maybe what might have been a message board in a village hall in the olden days is now perhaps a WhatsApp group, and someone will say, oh, could anyone help paint my fence? And then someone from the neighborhood can come round. So there are some benefits to modern technology, and I hope that there is more of this sense of we are all in this together. I think when it first started, it was in China, there was this tendency to think it's very far away, it's not going to affect me, but of course we're all affected. So this idea that we are interconnected, I think, is really helpful.
And you talk about balance as well, that so even when it comes to exercise, it's like exercise is good it's not good if it becomes something that you have to do every day. Yes. And you're punishing yourself if you don't do it. And
yes, I used to do a lot of classes at gyms with the word pump in them. And I was eating all the healthy things, but I was not at my most healthy. So yeah, it needs a balance. You can eat all the kale that you like. But if you are ignoring your sadness or you're incredibly stressed at work, it's not going to help. And we do need that rest to rejuvenate, to fire up the neurons ready for another day. And yeah, we need to eat food that is going to make us feel good, as well as things that we like.
Yeah, definitely. So your book is out in paperback now, and yes, it's available in Don't Buy Her Flowers packages,
yes,
which is really exciting. So it's arrived at the warehouse. So when this goes out, it's there. And you put together a selection of products that you would put with it. So there'll be a How to Be Sad package, but you've got, well, you can, I'll talk you through it, and you can, if there's anything you want to reference, but you've got Epsom salts, Willie's dark chocolate with roasted almonds, Rave coffee, which is really good, fresh coffee, and multicolored socks, and your book, obviously.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, socks, I think, much underrated gift. It's like a hug for your foot. Yeah. You put on a new sock and like the arch is like gently caressed by a bit of lovely soft cotton.
Rather than grotty ones with holes in.
A scratchy one that's hard. And the idea, like, we should all be bringing more colour into our lives, especially now and in winter. Mm. And then I think the coffee, I'm all about, not every day is going to be a happy day, but there are going to be moments of joy, and they are blissful and they are rare, and we should hold on to them when we can. And for me, one non-negotiable moment of pleasure every morning is having that first coffee of the day. Right. And I know it's going to be delicious, and I know it's going to be good, and whatever happens that day, I will really have enjoyed that. So I'm not great at meditating or any of that stuff, but just sipping that first coffee of the day brings all of the feels and is just a real, it starts the day on a high.
Yeah.
And then I think chocolate covered almonds, I still have a massively sweet tooth, and I try not to go in for any deprivation these days with, you know, history of eating disorders, but I'm also aware that the sugar crash is real. So if I can get some protein in there, that's all good. And that's, you know, you're feeling good about your day there with the almonds. And then what else did I have?
Epsom salts.
Yes. So magnesium for aching bones, because, you know, I'm in my 40s now.
I know,
sometimes
it's coming,
things ache.
Isn't it?
carrying kids, my goodness. And then also it can really help with helping your mind relax as well. So after a long day, I'm a big fan of an Epsom salts bath. And normally it takes quite a long time to get all of the kid toys out of the bath first. But when I do that, it's worth it.
What age is it when you can stop having loads of plastic shit in the bath? It's not enjoyable, is it? Because you think, oh, I'm going to have a quick bath. And then you've got to unload, like,
take Barbie out first. Yeah.
It drives me nuts.
Yes.
And then even then, if you take them out, they're perched on the edge and they'll inevitably one out end
fall
up in.
Yeah. So that's nice. Yeah.
Oh, good. No, thank you. So I think it's a really important book. Even just the one message about how we talk to our kids, I think, is a huge takeout, let alone what we can do for ourselves. But, you know, if we're messed up, why don't we try and stop our kids from being as messed up?
I think that's it for me as well. It's about we can think what we like about ourselves, but if I want to pay forward, if I want to sort of help other people to be happier as well, I have to kind of fix myself first. So that's
brilliant. Thank you so much, Helen.
Lovely to speak to you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed it, and if you have, please, as I said, could you rate, review and subscribe to the podcast? I'll be eternally grateful. I am now heading back to my mum and dad's for some tea. I don't know what my mum's rustled up, but they're waiting patiently for me, and I imagine a gin and tonic. And what I do love is when I stay at my mum and dad's, my mum will wrap my pyjamas in a hot water bottle in the winter and put them in my bed ready for when I go to bed, and it is probably one of the cutest things she does. So I might be nearly 41, but I still really do like that. And I think I've got a few things to ask my mum. So we've got a sex expert coming up in a few episodes, and I thought it'd be interesting to get my mum's perspective on a few things. So I'm going to need a gin and tonic to do that. But I also wanted to say, if you've got any questions or thoughts, if you want to email me at podcast@don'tbuyherflowers.com, and if any of those questions are about sex or anything to do with sex, stories about sex,
the rush hour in sex. I don't know if inviting people to send me things on email about sex is a good idea, but anyway, yeah, and then I can maybe cover off some of those questions with our expert when we record that episode. So I'd love to hear from you. And other than that, I hope you have a lovely week. Thank you.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.